Before I begin actually on the topic that I have, I'd like to start with just a personal observation. And the personal observation that I have is that the seeds for this conference were sown about 7 years ago in a class of fourth, fifth, and sixth graders at the First Baptist Church of Asheville, which is located about 20 miles south of here down toward Birmingham. I had the opportunity of teaching Bible drill to a group of fourth, fifth, and sixth grade boys and a few girls included in that class. And during the summer, we didn't actually do Bible drill. We picked a topic every summer to study. One summer we studied John Bunyan's classic Pilgrim's Progress. But one summer I decided to tackle the subject of how we got the English Bible. Well, as you can imagine, for a group of fourth, fifth, and sixth graders, that was about as dry as toast without butter. So one of the things that I thought would make a course on the English Bible much more interesting is if they could actually hold some of these Bibles in their hand. And so when you go next door to the museum, about a third of that collection over there was collected in order to be able to show fourth, fifth, and sixth graders what a Bible that's 400 years old actually looked like, what it actually felt like to hold it. There's a pastor from Cleveland, Alabama, which is located not too far from here, who sat in my living room for almost 2 hours one day, just absolutely stunned by the fact that he could hold the Word of God that's over 400 years old in his hand. Now, if you go to the museum, everything over there is behind glass cases. But if you come to the grand opening event tomorrow, we're actually going to open up a couple of those glass cases and get out some of the Bibles for you to actually hold in your hand, leaf through it, read it. You can read some of the family genealogies and notes that are inside those Bibles. It is very interesting. The museum curator is just absolutely livid over the fact that we would actually let people handle Bibles that are 400 years old. But it is our view as part of this conference that the Bible was meant for man to handle. And that's one of the things that I will emphasize in the history of the Bible before 1611 is there were men who lived and men who died, martyrs, in order for us to be able to hold the English Bible in our hand. And so why should we today put a Bible under a glass case and say, don't touch it, when these men didn't just pay a few thousand dollars for a Bible? They paid with their life's blood for the Bible. The other personal note that I like to start with is the friendships and the partnerships that we've made throughout this process. Gadsden Primitive Baptist Church is not a large church, but the scope of this conference has been really international. Pastor Rogers will, at some point, when we have a few extra minutes, actually give you the anecdotal story of how this conference came to pass. It started as a very small idea, and if you look around you today, you'll see more than 70 people here on a Friday. Tomorrow, we expect to have more than 100 people here studying the history of the English Bible with us. But some of the partnerships, the building that you're sitting in is a cultural arts center, the Mary G. Hardin Center for Cultural Arts. We have a very good relationship with the people here. The exhibit upstairs, Ink and Blood, we call it Sweat and Blood because several of us put in about 60 hours of labor assembling all the displays that you see upstairs in Ink and Blood. The Museum of Art, two doors down, has been a great help to us in displaying these Bibles so that a lot more people can see them. A couple of the churches in the area, Emmanuel Baptist and also Harvest Christian Fellowship, have been instrumental in helping us put this conference together. Those personal notes aside, I turn to my topic for the day, and my topic is the English Bible before 1611. I dare say there's Christians out there in the United States today that have no idea that there actually was an English Bible that existed before the year 1611. I dare say there's also Christians in America today that don't even know that the Bible that the majority of the churches are using actually came from 1611. But the history of the Bible, the English Bible, before the year 1611, is a very rich history. I believe this is probably the funnest presentation that you will see during the course, because it's really a story of people. About a dozen people that we will go through in some level of detail who contributed to the fact that we have an English Bible in our hands today. Now, Dr. Ella is going to give us further detail on a couple of the most prestigious and prominent of these individuals. So it's my view to give you about 5 minutes of history of about a dozen different people who contributed to the English Bible that we have in our hand today. Translations of the Bible from the original Greek and Hebrew languages is no new thing. Take, for example, the Septuagint that you see an example of up on the screen. The Septuagint is a translation of the Old Testament from the Hebrew language into the Greek language. It was prepared for the great library in Alexandria. The time frame of the translation of the Septuagint was about 285 B.C., although it really was an ongoing project that lasted up until the 1st century B.C. So the Septuagint was translated in 285 B.C., but it continued to be worked on up until the 1st century B.C. The word Septuagint means the 70, and it derives its title from the story, and it's mainly a mythological story, but it does bear a little truth. It derives from the story that it took 70 Jewish scholars, or some say 72 Jewish scholars, 70 days to prepare the translation. Now, if you know anything about translating the Bible, you know that that would be an astronomical feat if it indeed happened that way. For 70 people to agree upon a translation, and that it only took 70 days, is unheard of in history. We'll find that when we get to some of these other translations, that some of them have been were worked on for 20 and 30 years before the translation actually went to some type of publication or acceptance. The Septuagint remains a popular resource even today. If you have a Bible that has footnotes that denote where certain variations of the text come from, you will see the Septuagint referenced in the footnotes of your Bible. Often you will see it abbreviated LXX, which is the Roman numeral 70. It is probably the oldest of several ancient translations of the Hebrew Bible into the Greek language. It is definitely the most well-known of those translations of the Hebrew Bible into the Greek language. An item which I will talk about if we have time toward the end is the Apocrypha. The Apocrypha is a group of books that is found in Catholic Bibles generally, but usually not found in our Protestant Bibles that are published today. The Septuagint included this Apocrypha that I will talk about later on. The Septuagint was held in great respects. Two prominent historians from around the time of Jesus, Philo and Josephus, both ascribe inspiration to the translators of the Septuagint. Now, we as Protestants in general don't believe that anybody except for the original authors and the original autographs were inspired, but there were people that believed the Septuagint was so important that its translators were inspired. Of significance regarding the Septuagint, for all Christians and for all Bible scholars, the Septuagint is often quoted by the New Testament authors. If you go through the sources of the quotes that are used by our New Testament authors, Peter and John and Paul, you will often find that their quotes don't come out of the Hebrew text of the Bible. They come out of the Septuagint translation of the Bible. Many of the apostolic fathers immediately after the time of the apostles also used the Septuagint when they provided quotes from the Old Testament. The oldest surviving copies of the Septuagint are those two codexes that Pastor Rogers referenced during his presentation, Codex Vaticanus and Codex Synacticus. Both contain Greek text of the Old Testament, and they are of the Septuagint variety. Those two texts date back to the 4th century A.D., somewhere around 350 A.D. You've heard the word codex a few times. Just as a matter for those who don't know what codex means, codex basically means a bound book, as opposed to a scroll, which we're all familiar with. Codex means nothing more than just being a bound book. Another translation that I would like to talk about pre-English is the Latin Vulgate translation of the Bible. The Latin translation, or the Vulgate translation of the Bible, was translated primarily by the work of one person, and that person, it was Jerome. He was a Catholic scholar. He began work on this translation of the Bible in 382 A.D. It was done at the request of Pope Damasus, who was Pope at that time. Jerome's work is known as the Latin Vulgate. It was completed in 405 A.D. So right there you can see that it took almost 20 years of work by this scholar to translate the Bible from the Hebrew and the Greek languages into the Latin language, which was common for that day. It is interesting because the Latin Vulgate is still used in many Roman Catholic churches today, and it has remained practically unchanged since the year 405 A.D. Why is it called the Vulgate? Vulgate is a Latin term. It translated into the word vulgar in our English language. That doesn't mean it was nasty or doesn't mean it was desecrated or anything like that. Vulgar meant common. It was translated into the common Latin dialect of that day, a language which most everybody in the Roman Empire could speak. However, the Vulgate remained the standard version of the Bible that was available for over 1.5 millennia, over 1,500 years. And by the end of that 1,500-year period, the Latin language had basically died out of common use. So the people from the history of the Protestant Reformation from that time in the 1500s were using a Bible which only the scholars knew the language of, which was Latin. The vast majority of the people in the church could not read and they could not understand the language of the Latin Vulgate, even though they heard passages read from the Vulgate every time that they went to church. Another thing that made the Bible very inaccessible to the common person of the 1400s and the 1500s was that there was really not a widespread printing of the Bible at that time. The Latin Vulgate was the only version of the Bible available in the 1400s and the early 1500s. Even when the Gutenberg invented the printing press, there was still not a lot of Bibles printed, and if they were, they were printed in a language that wasn't common among the people of that time. The next person in our history, in our parade of personalities leading up to the English Bible, is John Wycliffe. John Wycliffe is known as the morning star of the Protestant Reformation. Almost 200 years before the beginning of the Protestant Reformation, as we know it under Martin Luther and John Calvin and other such luminaries, John Wycliffe actually began a Protestant Reformation. It wasn't successful. It never formed any denominations like we have that came from the Protestant Reformation. But John Wycliffe was the original Protestant reformer of note in the European continent. He's known as the morning star of the Protestant Reformation because he gave a sign of what was going to occur a couple of hundred years later during the actual Reformation. Wycliffe was the first person to translate the Bible into English. There were some small passages that had been translated over the years. Bede, for instance, in England, translated portions of the book of John. In fact, there's a pulpit that survives from the time that actually has portions of John chapter 1 inscribed on the front of the pulpit that Bede used. But Wycliffe was the first person to make a widespread translation of the Bible into English. By the time he died, he had translated the entire Bible into English. The basis for his work was not the original languages. It was not Greek and it was not the Hebrew. Wycliffe translated the English Bible that he did from the Latin Vulgate. Wycliffe was a very interesting person, and I look forward to hearing an hour-long lecture on him tonight. I'm going to give you just a couple of minutes to whet your appetite for that lecture. He was born in 1324, during the time that Black Death plagues were rampant in Europe. Wycliffe joined Oxford College at a very young age, received a doctorate, and was also ordained as a Roman Catholic priest. However, somewhere around 1375, when he was around 50 years old, Wycliffe led in a conflict between Oxford College and the Roman Catholic Church, and that conflict was over a doctrine that's called, are you ready for a big word, transubstantiation. Now, several of you in here are scholars and know what transubstantiation means, but I had to look it up, and what I found was transubstantiation is the belief that during the Mass that the bread and the wine that were used actually became the body and the blood of Jesus Christ. Well, that was a standard belief in the Roman Catholic Church for years, for centuries. John Wycliffe and his colleagues at Oxford University challenged that belief. They said, no, it doesn't. It is symbolic. And that yielded a fight that would become a fight of the nation of England against the Roman Catholic Church. The Roman Catholic Church would bring Wycliffe to trial several times. He was finally forced to resign his positions at Oxford University, became for lack of a better term, a pastor of a very rural church in England. And that's where he began translating the Bible. He began translating in 1378. In 1380, he had a complete New Testament translated. We actually have not an original, but a facsimile copy of that 1380 New Testament over in the museum for you to see. He completed the entire Bible in 1382. We must remember that Wycliffe's work was prior to the invention of the printing press. Making a single copy of this Bible took about 10 months. And if you were fortunate enough to be able to have the opportunity to buy one, it took over a month's pay for a professional worker to actually buy one of these Bibles. Needless to say, the Roman Catholic Church was furious over the translation of this Bible into English. However, Wycliffe died in 1384 before they could really do anything about it. However, the Roman Catholic Church was so infuriated by this translation of the Bible and also by the Reformed views of Wycliffe, they had his bones dug up in the year 1428, burned, and then thrown in the river near where he was died as a pastor. The oldest surviving copies of Wycliffe's work date back to about 1392. You will see over in the museum a two-volume set of Wycliffe's entire Bible when you get a chance to visit that. The next person in the parade is Johann Gutenberg. Johann Gutenberg never translated the Bible, but he is important because he is the first person to print a Bible. Around the year 1450, and these are my words and you're welcome to disagree, perhaps the most historical event since the birth, crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus Christ occurred. That's my opinion. But I believe that this invention of the printing press is one of the major historical events that has occurred since the time of Christ. Why? Because this one event was what was needed in order to begin taking the Bible out of the hands of professional clergy and putting it into the hands of common people. Johann Gutenberg, as we've heard earlier, one of his first major works off of the printing press was the Latin Vulgate Bible. There are somewhere around 82 of these Bibles still remaining in the world today. Johann Gutenberg lived from about 1398 until 1468. He did his work in Germany. He was a goldsmith by trade and became a printer as part of his father's business. His major work, the Gutenberg Bible, we have the facsimile of it that you'll look at. It's incredible for something that was produced in the year, approximately the year 1450. You just have to see it to believe it, the amount of artwork that was put into that Bible that long ago. You will, upstairs in the Ink and Blood exhibit, if you get a chance to go up there, you'll see a working copy of a Gutenberg-type printing press. It was developed from a screw that was used to press olives in order to make olive oil. What his Gutenberg's truly great invention was combinations of this olive and typeset press, typeset blocks, into something that could actually mass produce a printed page. Gutenberg's technology spread rapidly through Europe. In addition to what we're talking about here, the history of the English Bible, it's also credited as one of the things that really began the Renaissance in Europe. Gutenberg is a towering figure in popular image today. In 1999, the Arts and Entertainment Network on TV ranked Johann Gutenberg number one, that's number one, on the people of the millennium. For the last 1,000 years, they ranked Johann Gutenberg number one on top. In 1997, Time Life magazine picked Johann Gutenberg as the and his invention as the most important of the second millennium. So even today, the work of Johann Gutenberg is recognized, and even in popular culture, his contribution is recognized as being important. Continuing on in the parade, Desiderius Erasmus, the ubiquitous so-called author of the Textus Receptus. Very shortly after Johann Gutenberg's work, another very significant event in the history of the English Bible occurred. In the year 1516, Desiderius Erasmus, a Dutch scholar, gathered together, and I want you to pay very close attention to the number, gathered together six Greek manuscripts. Six. What was the number Pastor Rogers gave us? 5,623, I believe. Well, Desiderius Erasmus gathered together six of those Greek manuscripts dating from the 12th to the 15th centuries of the New Testament. He collated them. He criticized them, which doesn't mean he was down on them. It means he compared them one against another and produced a New Testament in modern Greek. After many revisions, this text that Desiderius Erasmus produced in 1516 would eventually be known as the Textus Receptus, or translated into English, the Received Text. The Greek text of Erasmus is often called the spark that would ignite the Protestant Reformation. It was the first step in moving the Bible away from the Latin language and into a language that was actually comprehensible by the common person. Not that the common person could understand Greek that well, but Greek was a very easy language to translate into other languages. The Greek text of Erasmus and those later editions became the basis of several very important Bibles. Remember, Erasmus did his work in 1516. In 1522, Martin Luther took that text and produced a German Bible. In 1526, William Tyndale got a hold of that text and produced an English Bible. The Geneva Bible, published in 1560, relied upon Erasmus's text. The King James Version of 1611 relied upon work that followed Erasmus's text. So you can see, within 100 years, the work that was performed by Desiderius Erasmus led to the ability for the common person to have a Bible in their hands. A few facts surrounding the Textus Receptus, since that is important to us as we consider the King James Bible later on. The first edition was published by Erasmus in the year 1516. It was based on 6 manuscripts dating only back to the 12th to the 15th centuries. The last 6 verses of Revelation were missing in all those manuscripts. They were translated from guess where? The Latin Vulgate. Erasmus published more editions in 1519, 1522. It was in 1522 that he first added what's called the Comma Johannine. 1 John 5, verses 7 through 8, and I won't read them, but you'll recognize them when I say just a few words. There are 3 that bear witness in heaven. There are 3 that bear witness on earth. That was first added in 1522 to Erasmus's Greek text. It was only found in a margin of one of those Greek texts. But there was so much pressure for him to, because it was found in the Latin Vulgate. It turns out that there are very few other Greek texts that actually have 1 John chapter 5, verses 7 through 8 in the actual text itself. More editions of this Greek text were done by Robert Stephanus, 1550 and 1551. Interesting bit of trivia. The edition that came out in 1551 was the first text to ever have verse numbers. So the chapters and the verses are not inspired. The chapters were added in the year 1236 by a cardinal of the Roman Catholic Church. Verse numbers were not added to your Bibles until the year 1551. Theodore Beza in Geneva, working as a student of John Calvin and then a successor of John Calvin, published more editions in 1565 up through the year 1611. It was his work that became the basis for the 1611 Authorized Version or King James Version of the Bible. Finally, the Elzevir brothers in London printed more editions in 1624 through 1633. It's their 1633 edition that was first called the Textus Receptus because of a line in their introduction. This is now the text received by all, or in the Latin, Textus Receptus. Now, does that qualify me for the Bible? I spoke a little Latin there. Now, the 1633 edition is the basis of the King James Bible that most of us carry today. Very few people realize that the 1611 King James Bible is not the same Bible that we carry today. The Bible was edited extensively by Robert Blaley in 1769, including correcting all differences between Beza's Textus Receptus for Greek text and the 1633 Elzevir brothers' text. As we've mentioned over in the museum, you'll see a 1644 printing of Elzevir brothers' Textus Receptus. There is one more Greek text that was published in the Textus Receptus tradition in the year 1873 by Oxford University, never really used for anything at all. The next person in the parade is William Tyndale. The first printed English New Testament is attributed to William Tyndale. William Tyndale made it his life's mission to translate the Bible into English. He had to flee England, and he ended up with Martin Luther in Germany for a while in order to do his work. His famous quote as he left England was this: "I defy the Pope and all his laws, and if God spares me, I will one day make the boy that drives the plow in England to know more of the Scriptures than the Pope does." That's William Tyndale's life's goal. William Tyndale completed the New Testament in 1526. He traveled throughout Europe, hunted by the Roman Catholic Church, running from printer to printer, having this New Testament printed. In the museum, there's a facsimile copy of, there's actually two facsimile copies of 1526 New Testaments published by William Tyndale. Tyndale Bibles were smuggled into England. They were smuggled into England from Europe in sacks of flour because there was a famine in Europe, in England at the time that this Bible was first being printed. So there was daily sacks and sacks of flour flowing from Europe into England, and many, many of those sacks of flowers had a Tyndale New Testament Bible stuffed in the top of the sack. In 1535, Tyndale was arrested by the Roman Catholic Church, jailed in the castle of Vilvoorde outside of Brussels, Belgium, for over a year. He was tried for heresy and burned at the stake. He was strangled while he was being burned for translating the Bible into English. At this point, we probably ought to interject just a little history on the English Reformation. The English Reformation occurred primarily not as a result of religious protestation, but political. Many of us know the story of King Henry VIII. He desired to divorce Catherine of Aragon and marry Anne Boleyn. The only problem was the Pope at that time would not grant the divorce. So in order to solve this problem, in the year 1534, England broke away from the Roman Catholic Church and formed what we know as today the Anglican Church. Thomas Cranmer, who was Archbishop of Canterbury at that time, became the head, not the titular head, but the actual head of the church. He granted Henry VIII's divorce, and Henry became the first titular or titled head of the Church of England, or as we know it today, the Anglican Church. One very interesting thing that arises out of this time is the Book of Common Prayer. Anybody ever heard the phrase, ashes to ashes, dust to dust? I'm sure many of you pastors have used that conducting a funeral. Well, that phrase has its roots in the Book of Common Prayer. And another one for the pastors: do you take this woman to be your lawfully wedded wife? That also has its roots in the Book of Common Prayer. Continuing down the parade, Miles Coverdale and the first printed complete English Bible. William Tyndale, unfortunately, did not get to complete the entire Bible before he was executed. His work was taken up by two different people, Miles Coverdale and John Rogers, working separately. Coverdale published an entire English Bible in the year 1535. He made use of Tyndale's translation of the New Testament and those books that Tyndale had worked on in the Old Testament that included the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch, and also the Book of Jonah. The Coverdale Bible is interesting because Henry VIII ordered that one of these Coverdale Bibles be put into every church in England. So it was really the first nationally recognized Bible of the Church of England in English. They chained it to the pulpit or to a book stand in order to prevent it from being stolen, but in order that every citizen could have access to the Bible. Working separately but at the same time as Coverdale is John Rogers. John Rogers is the person who prepared the first English Bible that was actually printed in England. He published the entire Bible in 1537. It's known as the Matthew's Bible. Now you ask, why is that? Why would somebody by the name of John Rogers, when he published a Bible, put the name Matthew's on the front of it? Well, when you get down to the end of John Rogers' story, you know exactly why he did it. John Rogers was put to death for translating the Bible. Translating the Bible was a very dangerous thing to do in this time of history. The complete Bible was put under the pseudonym of Thomas Matthews in 1537. It was first printed in Paris and in Antwerp, but then at the insistence of Archbishop Cranmer, it was granted the king's most gracious license, and it was printed in England. His work inspired the Great Bible, which we'll discuss in a second, the Bishop's Bible, and also the King James Version of the Bible. On the ascension of Mary, Queen of Scots, we know her better today as Bloody Queen Mary, John Rogers was still in England, and he suffered her wrath for translating the Bible. Mary, Queen of Scots, was a devout Catholic and was tempted to return England to the Roman Catholic Church. One thing she did was execute Christians who had been part of the English Reformation, and that included John Rogers, who was put to death in the year 1555 for his work in translating the English Bible. Thomas Cranmer is the next person in our parade. We've heard his name a couple of times, but in 1539, Thomas Cranmer ordered a new translation of the Bible to be published. That translation of the Bible is called the Great Bible. And it is called the Great Bible because of its size. When you go to the museum next door, and I realize I've said that a lot, but I want to encourage you to go look at these, you can easily pick out the Great Bible because it is without a doubt the biggest Bible in the entire display over there. Every church in England was required to buy one of these Great Bibles and have it available in front of the church for everybody to read. It was also usually chained to a book stand or a pulpit to keep it from being stolen. Cranmer was Archbishop of Canterbury, head of the Church of England. However, when Bloody Queen Mary ascended back to the throne, he was in prison for 2 years. He made a recantation, which means he went back on his Protestant dealings. However, on the day that he went to trial, he took back his recantation and he was executed for his role in the Protestant Reformation in England. Next, Theodore Beza, the Geneva Bible. During the reign of Bloody Queen Mary, many English Protestants fled to Europe. Many of them ended up in Geneva, which is on the shores of Lake Geneva in Switzerland. There they began work on a translation of the English Bible known as the Geneva Bible, which was first published in the year 1560. The Geneva Bible has a couple of alternate names that are very interesting. One of those alternate names is the Breeches Bible. And that comes from Genesis 3:21, where Adam and Eve sewed fig leaves together, then God slew some animals and provided skins for them. God provided them breeches, or breeches in the language of that time. The Geneva Bible is also known as the Pilgrim's Bible, very simply because when the pilgrims sailed to the New World, to America, it was the Geneva Bible that came with them. Even though we know the date of the Mayflower is 1620, you would think, well, they were carrying the King James Bible. No, the pilgrims carried the Geneva Bible when they came to the New World. The Geneva Bible is one of the earliest translations of the Bible into English, preceded the King James Bible by approximately 51 years. It's the primary Bible that was used by the 16th century Protestant movement. It's the Bible that was used by William Shakespeare, John Knox, John Donne, John Bunyan, all used the Geneva Bible. It's the Bible that came over on the Mayflower. It's the Bible that Oliver Cromwell's soldiers used. Because the language of the Geneva Bible was forceful, and that's an understatement, most readers, Protestant readers, preferred it over other translations of the Bible. The first edition appeared in 1560. It was first printed in England in 1575 and 1576. Over 150 editions of the Geneva Bible were printed, and it did not cease being printed until the year 1644. The first Bible ever printed in Scotland was a Geneva Bible in the year 1579. That is largely attributed to John Knox, who was one of the people who worked on the translation of the Geneva Bible in Switzerland. In Scotland, a law was passed in 1579 requiring every household to buy a Geneva Bible. Now imagine if that would happen in America today. Matthew Parker and the Bishop's Bible. In 1559, Queen Elizabeth, who came to the throne after Queen Mary, commissioned Matthew Parker to prepare a new English Bible for the Church of England. The Church of England didn't necessarily care a lot for the Geneva Bible, because not only was the Geneva Bible very Protestant, it was also very anti-king. And so the Church of England, with their affiliation with the monarchy of England, didn't have a great deal of respect or admiration for the Geneva Bible. So in 1559, Queen Elizabeth commissioned a new Bible that would become known as the Bishop's Bible, first published in 1568. It's known as a Bishop's Bible because it was the first Bible really translated by a committee of bishops. When you go to the museum, there's a Bishop's Bible in there, printed in 1585. It's the oldest Bible in the collection that we have in the museum today. One more Bible to talk about is the Douay-Rheims Bible. After the Catholic Church lost power in England following the death of Queen Mary, many of those Catholics, just like the Protestants had to do back in 1553, many of the Catholics fled England, and they ended up in France. In 1609, those Catholics that had fled to France ended up in two universities, the University at Douay, the University at Rheims, and they worked in translating the Bible into English from the Latin Vulgate. It was published in three volumes. You'll see facsimile copies of those three volumes over in the museum. There are several Bibles that come from this Douay-Rheims Bible, the New American Bible, the Revised Standard Version of the Bible, the New Revised Standard Version of the Bible, the New Jerusalem Bible, are all derivatives of this Douay-Rheims Bible. I include one Bible in my presentation that comes from after the year 1611, and that's the English Hexapla. The English Hexapla is the first modern parallel Bible. It was published in the year 1841. It's called the Hexapla because it contains six versions of the Bible in parallel columns. Wycliffe, Tyndale, the Great Bible, the Geneva Bible, the Douay-Rheims Bible, and the King James Version of the Bible were all arranged in parallel columns under the Greek text of the Textus Receptus. The name Hexapla means sixfold, and that comes from the six columns of text that was published in the Bible. I want to say a word in passing before I conclude about the Apocrypha. Maybe somebody else will cover the Apocrypha in more detail, but it does deserve to be mentioned as part of the history of the English Bible. You have probably figured out by now that not all Bibles contain the same 66 books which the typical Protestant Bible has today. The Apocrypha is another set of books plus a few additional chapters of some books in our Old Testament. They're sometimes called the deuterocanonical books or the second canon. The word Apocrypha comes from the Greek. It means secret books or hidden books. If you find them at all in a Protestant Bible, they're usually bound in a group between the Old Testament and the New Testament. Today, the books of the Apocrypha are mainly used by the Roman Catholic Church. And if you pick up a Catholic Bible, you'll actually find these books are interspersed throughout the Old Testament in their so-called correct or their chronological order. You'd also notice if you picked up a Roman Catholic Bible, and I have one over here if you'd like to look at one during the break, that the names of the books aren't necessarily the same as the names of the books that we're used to in the Old Testament. I mention the Apocrypha because it's interesting what translations of the Bible had the Apocrypha in it. The Septuagint, the Greek translation, had the Apocrypha in it. Other early Greek manuscripts had the Apocrypha in it. Jerome's Latin Vulgate translation had the Apocrypha in it. Wycliffe's English Bible had the Apocrypha in it. The Geneva Bible has the Apocrypha in it. The King James Bible, the 1611 King James Bible, has the Apocrypha in it. And when we open up the cases tomorrow, I invite you to check me out. Open up the 1616 and the 1624 King James Bible that we have out, and sure enough, you'll find the Apocrypha in those Bibles. They were really not systematically removed from the Bible until 1520, and they were removed by Protestants such as Martin Luther. They're still found in the Catholic Bible today. It's interesting, though, they're really not found in any Hebrew manuscripts. They're found in the Greek translations of the Hebrew manuscripts, but never in the actual Hebrew manuscripts themselves. In conclusion, I'd like to point out what I call family trees. The family trees that I have here for you are how Bibles actually derive from each other. The Textus Receptus from 1516, the Greek text by Desiderius Erasmus, gave rise in England, in English, to Tyndale's New Testament, which then became the basis for Coverdale's translation and then the Geneva Bible. Working separately, the Tyndale is the predecessor of the Matthew's Bible, the Great Bible, the Bishop's Bible, the King James Bible, and even today, the New King James Bible. Another family tree of Bibles that existed before 1611 began with the Latin Vulgate, Jerome's work of 405. Wycliffe used that. The Douay-Rheims Bible used that. And then a whole host of other English translations of the Bibles by the Catholic Church, the Confraternity Bible, Jerusalem Bible, New American Bible, and the New Jerusalem Bible. That concludes my presentation, a quick walk through 300 years of history, a quick walk in a parade of a dozen people, many of which of them gave their lives so that we could have the English Bible in our possession today.